dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the men that I've come to admire most because of his deep understanding of not just the present moment in which we find ourselves in this long-running, well, multi-generational, multi-century, one might argue, war for the free world, or for Western civilization is another way to think of it, is Raymond Ibrahim. He is a deeply accomplished author, notably, most recently, of The Sword and the Scimitar, 14 centuries of war between Islam and the West, and also of Crucified Again, exposing Islam's new war on Christians. We will be talking with him at length about these topics. Let me just say he is a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, a Rosen Fellow at the Middle East Forum, and a Fellow of the Gatestone Institute, all estimable organizations, and very proud to have him as not only a colleague of now some time and also a friend, and we're delighted always to showcase his work. You can follow it at RaymondIbrahim.com. Raymond, it's good to have you back. Welcome, and thank you for giving us a full hour of your time. There is so much to talk about, and it's been a while since we've visited, so I'm really appreciative. So let me just start by asking you, if you would, Raymond, to reprise kind of the, well, the distilled essence, if you would, of your terrific book about 14 centuries of battles between Islam and the West, as a just sort of departure for a discussion of what we're facing in our own time.
Sure, Frank. So I'll tell you real brief what the book is about, and then I'll tell you what the significance is. So the book is just what you said, Sword and Scimitar is the title, and the subtitle, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West, is the topic. And in eight chapters, I go chronologically, looking at Islam's invasions, attacks, and conquests onto what we today call the West, but what was then mostly called, you know, the Christian world, Christendom, the post-Roman world. And that went on. What you find out, of course, is what most people don't realize. So today when you talk to someone and you talk about the Muslim world, or if I talk about Christians, indigenous Christians being persecuted in the Muslim world, in Egypt, so forth, the first thing they'll tell me is, well, I feel bad, but why are they there? And that's what you come to find out. Well, they're there because they're the original. And all these lands that we think of as Islamic inherently, from Egypt to Morocco and all of North Africa, all of the Middle East, Syria, you know, Jordan and Turkey, all of that was, of course, the older Christian region, more so than Europe, much more so. And all of that was wrested through extreme violence and in the name of jihad from Islam. And so the book goes chronologically from 4 years after Muhammad dies and the first invasions into greater Syria, which was, of course, Roman, Byzantine, Christian at the time. And then 100 years later, the conquests found them. 100 years after Muhammad died, he dies in 632, is the traditional date. In 732, Islam is deep into France, finally being stopped at the Battle of Tours. But it had conquered all of North Africa and all of Spain, of course, and was raiding all throughout France. And this continues all throughout. You know, people don't realize in the 800s, Rome was basically sacked, the Vatican, by Muslim raiders in the name of jihad. And around the same time, there was an Islamic cell in the mountains in the Alps in Switzerland, which was devoted to raiding Christian villages and enslaving them and selling them in North Africa. So this sort of thing goes on, and most people, of course, don't know. And what I tried to do is document it mostly from primary sources, especially Arabic language sources and other Islamic Turkish sources, but also Greek, Byzantine, Latin, and all that, and all those sources to show you that this is their words. You know, this isn't me. I'm not. This isn't my idea. But the long and short of it, this goes on until, you know, at 1683, which isn't that long ago, and now we're talking about more than one millennium after the death of Muhammad, and now you have the largest Islamic army entering into Europe. You have almost 300,000 jihadis coming into Vienna, marching, besieging it, and having a massive war. You know, lots of carnage. The book has all the details of the battles, of course. And the what one gets from this, the lesson now, is that when anyone comes up and starts talking, all these analysts and experts and, you know, talking heads in the media, when they come up and tell us that ISIS, the Islamic State, and these groups, what they're doing has nothing to do with Islam, that is complete bunk, because what this book will show is that from the very beginning of Islam, it acted just like ISIS, except on a much grander scale and on an exponential level, because it wasn't just a random cell. It was actually the caliphates, the heads of states, the sultanates, who were talking like ISIS and who were behaving like ISIS. Some 15 million Europeans were actually enslaved during this long, more than 1,000-year war, just like, you know, we see Yazidi women and Christian women being sold in the slave markets, and we're told that's not. Well, think about 15 million.
This is such a, if I could just interrupt you for a second, this is such a critical point, Raymond, that we are endlessly told that the Islamic State, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, now unlimitedly deceased, were somehow hijacking Islam. They were somehow, you know, miscasting it or mispracticing it, if you will. And yet what you're saying is when they claim to be following the true faith, when they claim to be adhering to Sharia and seeking through jihad to impose it worldwide, they actually are carrying forth the practices of that faith under its authorities going back to Muhammad's day. Is that right?
That's what history documents. And, you know, today, unfortunately, historians, along with general political correctness, another thing they do is they sideline religion and they talk about nationality. So they'll talk about the Turkish invasions and conquests via the Ottomans or Seljuks. They'll talk about the Tatars and the Mongol, the Tatar yoke in Eastern Europe and so forth. They'll talk about Berbers and Moors. But when you dig deeper and look at the sources, as I have and documented in Sword and Scimitar, you're going to find that all these different national groups were following the same exact ideology that ISIS did. And so they may have been speaking different languages, you know, Farsi and Arabic and Turkic and, you know, Mongolian, but they all presented their invasions and attacks and conquests and enslavement of Europeans in identical terms that ISIS does. And we're talking about over one millennium of that constantly popping up.
So this is not an isolated incident by any means in terms of what's happened in our time, nor is it possible to, you know, really extricate the tenets of Islam, not that all Muslims practice them, for heaven's sakes, thank goodness, but the tenets, the authoritative traditions, the teachings of Muhammad himself from this kind of violence and jihadism. We're going to talk much more about this in the next segment when we visit with Raymond Ibrahim, among other things, about Muslim-on-Muslim violence and what we might learn from that. He is, again, the author of the terrific book, Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined for this full hour by one of the most extraordinary raconteurs of what has happened over, well, over a millennium of conflict between Islam and the West, the subject of his terrific book, Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. He is Raymond Ibrahim. You can find his work at raymondibrahim.com and on the websites of, well, just about every outlet that matters. His associations with the David Horowitz Freedom Center, the Middle East Forum, and the Gatestone Institute among them. Raymond, we were talking about the traditions the teachings, the tenets, the practices, the diktat, ostensibly from Allah, the God of Islam, and its prophet Muhammad, that have been practiced for 14 centuries, as you say. One of the peculiar things about this that I think is lost on most of us is the degree to which Muslims themselves have been victimized by the practitioners of Sharia. What is up with that, and how has that been manifesting itself not only over time but in ours as well?
Well, it's true, Frank. Often in many ways, Muslims are the first victims of Sharia. First and foremost, because 99% of the Muslims around the world didn't choose Islam. They were born into it. According to Islamic teaching, if your father was a Muslim and you're born to him, doesn't even matter what your mother is, you are a Muslim. It's not like there's a baptismal rite or anything like that. So instantly you are under the dictates of Sharia, according to your fellow Muslims, at least. So you can imagine all the draconian teachings and, you know, punishments involved, and lots of Muslims, as I know you believe, just are not necessarily themselves on board with that, including because they're not even believers. You know, I've studied this a lot. I've watched a lot of Arabic programming, and so many of them, it's very superficial, but they, you know, they go along with it because, of course, it creates problems for them. But the greater point, I think, is like when you, for example, when you look at the Sunni and Shia conflict, which goes way back, very beginnings of Islam, you know, the first fitna and split and all that, and you find Sunnis and Shias have been slaughtering each other left and right, more so Sunnis killing Shias because they are the majority. But what's significant about all this, I think, to put it in context, is that this idea that Muslims fight and kill other Muslims has been used to sort of exonerate Islam, ironically, because what we're told is, so for instance, if I show that Muslims have an anti-Christian animus and they persecute Christians, well, then someone will come and tell you, well, yeah, but you know what, Muslims are the greatest victims of Islamic terror groups. So obviously it has nothing to do with the religion, or when Sunnis kill Shias or Shias kill Sunnis, because it's true, Islam teaches that you should not kill a fellow Muslim. But what people don't seem to understand is, actually, if anything, Sunni and Shia violence and that sort of schism in the Islamic world is further reflective of inherent violence in Islam. Because when a Sunni attacks a Shia, he's doing it under the same exact mentality as when he attacks a Jew, a Christian, or a Yazidi. He sees him as a not true Muslim. He's a false Muslim. He's a hypocrite. He's a heretic. He's an infidel. So if anything, it really highlights, you know, the hate. And Muhammad himself, ironically, he has a hadith or a saying which actually validates this, which he basically says there will be 72 nations or sects, but only one of them will be my true followers. So you can see how that kind of teaching actually, here's the actual quote, "This ummah or nation of mine will split into 73 sects. One will be in paradise and 72 will be in hell." And when he was asked which is the true one, he replied, "Al-Jama'ah," which basically means those who follow the Sunnah. And then you have all these different groups saying we follow the Sunnah and you don't follow the Sunnah, et cetera, et cetera.
It's a formula for fratricide, obviously, and it's been much in evidence over the years. But I guess like the point that is often overlooked in, you know, trying to assess what Islam is about and, you know, who is the true, shall we say, practitioner or leader of the faith, is that this dynamic tension is operating all the time. And we've been confused by it in part because we're told that these various sects, particularly the Sunni and the Shia, you know, don't get along and therefore can't possibly collaborate. And yet, I think what you've documented, among others, of course, Raymond Ibrahim, is that they perfectly well can get along when it comes to making common cause against people that they both regard as infidels or otherwise see as useful targets for their violent activities. Is that right?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And it just falls under the concept of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So again, remember, for a Sunni and a Shia, they see each other not necessarily as pure infidels. They see each other as heretics who are wronged and who should be fought and resisted until they're brought back into Islam. So I'll give you an example. And I was just watching this recently on an Arabic program, and the cleric said, any woman who is, he used the Arabic word, which means she's born as an infidel, kafr asli. So she was never a Muslim, you know, basically like a European woman or a Christian or Jewish woman. They can be enslaved as you know, right-hand possessions in the context of jihad. But then he said, he said all the jurists have consensus that they can be enslaved. But then he said, when it comes to former Muslim women or apostates or schismatics or heretics, such as Shias or Sunnis, there's debate. Some say they can be enslaved. Some say they should not be enslaved. So you can definitely see that to a Sunni and to a Shia, each other is better than the pure infidel. They're better than the Israeli. They're better than the European. They're better than the Christian. But then once you eliminate those latter groups and you just have Sunnis and Shias, well, then they fight each other. And again, it goes back to that, you know, Muhammad saying, you know, all these different sects, but only one is true. And it all depends on the context. You know, the greater the infidel presence, the more they gravitate and help each other. The less infidel presence, the more they start separating and fighting with each other.
Let me ask about, having now worked our way through the kind of vectors of the violence that Sharia has spawned over the years, Reverend Ibrahim, from, you know, sort of the generalized tradition of conquest and warfare over 14 centuries that you document with your selection of key battles in century after century after century. We've talked a bit about Muslim-on-Muslim violence. Let's talk a bit about the practice of persecution of minority faiths, particularly, for the moment, let's talk about Christians. You've done an immense amount of work on this. You are yourself a product of a Coptic Christian family, expatriates from Egypt, and you've closely studied what is being done, not just in the Middle East, but now around the world. Much of it, some 80%, we're told, of the, well, 260 million Christians who are being heavily persecuted, according to Open Doors USA, or the even larger number that are being persecuted in, you know, heavy and other ways that aid to the church in need is estimated 327 million, which is almost exactly the number of men, women, and children in the United States. So, Reverend Ibrahim, why is it that Islam engages so viciously in the persecution of people simply because they follow Jesus Christ?
Sure, Frank. And the quick and simple, easy answer is it's basically what we've been talking about. It's this anti-infidel animus that has animated Islam through the centuries and into the present. And so when you look today, as you mentioned, all these different human rights organizations regularly produce reports annually documenting the worst nations in the world to be Christian and so forth. And habitually, 80% are going to be Muslim nations. And usually the top 10 lists are at least 80% as well Islamic. And so that really tells you something. If all around the world, the majority of attacks on the Christians and basically anyone who's the other is happening by Muslims, that again validates what we're talking about, which is that Islam has this sort of tribal, antagonistic, dualistic worldview, us versus them. And so when you look at the north in the Middle East where Christians are being persecuted, and you mentioned, you know, the Copts in Egypt, where there's still 10% or maybe a little more, North Africa, you know, less than 1%. We've seen what happened in Syria and Iraq, thanks to ISIS. But even in nations like Turkey, which is supposedly secular, there's a great hatred for Christians. It's, of course, it's in Saudi Arabia. And also in Iran, which is also appears on these lists. But when you go through history, for example, if you look at Sword and Scimitar, you will see the same exact thing happening. But back when there were more Christians in all these nations that I mentioned, because they were, as we pointed out, originally Christian regions when Islam came. So what we're seeing is really the continuation of what started 14 centuries ago when Islam invaded these Christian lands of North Africa and the Middle East. And, think about it, Turkey, we all think about it as Islamic Turkey. And yet it was one of the most Christian regions. It's where St. Paul wrote so many of his letters to. And Antioch is where the word Christian was first used. But we don't think of that, and we just think of them Islamic. And that's because what we're seeing today has been going on for 14 centuries, a sort of slow motion persecution bleeding of Christians, which has seen them go extinct in certain regions, such as Turkey and North Africa, until very recently. and go from being virtually 100% majorities to, you know, 10% in Egypt and so forth. So it's the same animus that we're talking about. Nothing's changed. It's the same thing. It's the same. It's the same, you know, ideology that provokes Sunnis to attack Shias and Shias to attack Sunnis. It's the same one that makes them hate Israel. It's the same one that makes them hate Europe and America. And it is the very same one that makes them attack Christians. It's, you know, it's Quranic based. It's Sharia. We can talk forever about the doctrine of al-wala wal-bara, which is Arabic for love and hate, where Muslims are obligated, according to the Quran, to love fellow Muslims and work with them and hate non-Muslims, even if the non-Muslims are good to them and kind to them. So there's much to be said.
And the people of the book, who we're sometimes told are due special deference and treatment, not so much, is the bottom line. We're going to pause for just another moment with Raymond Ibrahim. Coming back, we'll talk about how apostates are treated by Islam, as well as what is done through nonviolent means to advance the Sharia and its jihad. All of that and more with the author of Sword and Scimitar and Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back for the third installment of this important conversation with one of the serious students of jihadism, of Sharia supremacism, the history of Islam and its interactions with the non-Islamic world. This is the subject of a splendid, relatively new book, Sword and Scimitar, 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. We're speaking of the David Horowitz Freedom Center Shulman Fellow, Raymond Ibrahim. And Raymond, again, thank you for your time. Let's just drill down on this issue that I think we can stipulate that not all Muslims want to live under Sharia. They don't want to impose it on everybody else. But what is operating within the world of Islam? I mean, you talked a little bit about Muslim-on-Muslim violence, but what beyond that is going on that prompts so few of them to be willing to express their disinterest in being part of the Sharia supremacist program, to the point where Pew polls, among others, sentiment around the world document almost exclusive, very high percentages of Muslims that are responding to the polls is saying that they're good with Sharia. They think it's all great. I'm interested particularly about here in the United States, but more generally, what do you think is going on there?
Well, one of the things that's going on, and it's, you know, we sort of touched on this earlier, is that if you're a Muslim who at heart is, you know, lukewarm or secularized, the last thing you want to do is draw attention to yourself. And so you will actually appear as a good Muslim or at least give lip service. So you will, if, you know, you will say you like, sure, you think Sharia is excellent. You believe in everything about the Quran and so forth. You believe in its application. That is one of the surest ways to actually not be scrutinized and have Sharia applied to you. And I, you know, I've seen this often and often, even historically. And a lot of Muslims will appear what we call radical, pro-Sharia, etc., when they're in the Islamic world. And then once they come to the West, often, you know, you see the truth come out and they become very secularized and they don't even talk much about Islam. Now, that is not, of course, to say that we don't have the exact opposite, okay, which is, and we have the exact opposite here in the West, which is the Muslim who appears secular and gives lip service to the secular idea, but at heart does want Sharia and is actively working for it. So it's important you bring it up because it's a very interesting and dynamic that permeates the entire world, Islamic and non-Islamic, in different ways. So certainly nuance is needed to truly understand what's going on. But, you know, for me, I simplify it in my own mind by always drawing a fine line between Islam and Muslims. And so Islam is Islam. You know, I can criticize it. I can say it is what it is. It teaches X, Y, and Z. It teaches, you know, the inferiority of women, jihad on infidels, death to apostates, or at least punishment. That is a fact. That's not me being unfair to it. Having said that, do I believe every single man named Muhammad believes this? No. nor just like I don't believe every man named John or Christian is a Christian, you know, follows Christianity and so forth. So, you know, but again, unfortunately, so many people conflate what I just said, these two ideas, and in being open-minded to the individual Muslim, they start covering for Islam itself. And I think that's the problem. So while it's fair to say I shouldn't paint all Muslims with one brush, that should not stop us from being critical of the ideology of Islam itself, because, again, that is something that would be quantified and analyzed and explained, that doesn't require a whole lot of nuance, because Islam is the law. It's Sharia. It's do this, don't do that.
And I think of that ideology as Sharia. Let me just then turn to the reality that many of the Muslims, particularly in our country, who are professing to be secular but are actually championing the Sharia agenda, seem to have, you know, either a role in or at least an affinity for the Muslim Brotherhood. And we've been told by, among others, the former director of national intelligence, James Clapper, that the Muslim Brotherhood has eschewed violence, that embraces essentially a peaceful practice of the faith. Based on your study of both what is compulsory within the Sharia traditions of Islam, and specifically, Raymond Ibrahim, how Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, and his, you know, successors and adherents practice their faith. Is, in fact, violence impermissible, out of the question, you know, rejected categorically by the Brotherhood? And how does what they certainly do, namely a kind of, well, they call it civilization jihad in some of their texts, how does that fit into the overall effort to accomplish the goals of world conquest and domination?
Yeah, great questions, Frank. So what we have to understand is the Muslim Brotherhood does formally condemn and eschew violence, okay? But why it does that is in the same, you know, pathway of jihad. So in other words, it's not because they believe violence is wrong and they believe in being tolerant of others, et cetera, but rather that instead of using violence, they use other means to do the same exact thing that violence has traditionally done in Islam, meaning jihad. And we go back to the very word jihad itself. And as you probably know, so many of the apologists, it used to be translated as holy war by the Orientalists. But then a lot of apologists told you, no, it has nothing to do with war. The word itself means strive, and basically strive for struggle, et cetera, to empower Islam. Well, that's exactly true. And if anything, that doesn't make it better. That makes it worse, because it just points out that in the ways that Muslims who are engaged in jihad can do it is not limited to violence. It could be jihad through propaganda. It could be jihad through subversion. It could be jihad through money and, you know, spending money for quote unquote charitable causes, which end up in the hands of jihadists. And so the Muslim Brotherhood is very much representative of this other jihad, the soft jihad, the civilizational jihad, which doesn't engage necessarily in violence. But it does, it works for the same exact thing that Al-Qaeda and ISIS and Boko Haram are working for. And so, unfortunately, in the West, people just see the fact that it's nonviolent, and immediately they get happy and say, oh, so here's an ally, they're good, et cetera, et cetera. The fact is, they are doing the same exact thing, but in a more effective way, which doesn't involve violence. And by the way, the violence, you know, it's so funny because when the Muslim Brotherhood was founded, it was very violent with Hassan Benna in Egypt. And then they learned, and in their internal conversations about eschewing violence, they made it very clear that it's not because violence is wrong, but rather because it's not the time for that now. Rather, if you look at their motto, their word in Arabic is wa'uddu, which basically means prepare. So think about it. Their actual word is just prepare. What are they preparing for? And on top of that word is two swords and the Quran.
And this is the point, Raymond. It's not that they eschew violence. It's that they don't think it's practicable at the moment. And they're going to use other techniques to advance the same goal. And they'll be quite content, I think it's fair to say, at least most of them, that if it comes to the point where violence will be practicable, they'll happily utilize it. That was actually, of course, Muhammad's perfect model, wasn't it? And as you've documented so well in Sword and Scimitar, that's been the practice as well.
When he was in Mecca, his early years, and he was outnumbered, and he just had basically a few dozen followers, that's when you get all those verses in the Quran that seem peaceful and preach tolerance. Once he moved and was in a, and he went to Medina, and he got stronger, and he was in a position to go on the offensive, all of a sudden now we got the violent verses coming, and he went on the offensive. So yes, absolutely, it's Muhammad's own life and pattern, and the pattern of the Quran's so-called revelation and the order it came in is very much reflective of this dichotomy between violent and nonviolent jihad.
This is such a key point because those early verses are at odds, of course, with the later verses. And would you just explain what I believe is a seminal element in the formulation and promulgation of Sharia, namely the principle of abrogation? How did that work, Raymond?
Well, abrogation, or in Arabic, nasikh wal mansukh, is without this idea or this tool, the Quran is completely unintelligible, and you cannot understand it. Because if we want to be honest, if you look at the Quran from beginning to end, it's just essentially abstract, redundant, and contradictory poetry. That's what it really is.
Organized, interestingly enough, more or less by the length of the surah, which seems to be designed to obscure the true character of the thing.
Right. So the first surah, you know, the cow, is the first one, only because it happens to be the longest, as you said. But so abrogation, this doctrine, what it did is it basically said, since the Quran says many things that contradict often, what we'll do is we'll take the last revelation. So the later verses are the ones that you are supposed to apply. However, the earlier verses also apply if you find yourself in that situation, which goes back to what we were saying. So we've seen, for example, the earlier verses of Muhammad's career is when he was weaker. And so he preached tolerance, and he was living amongst infidels, the Quraysh, the polytheists or pagans of Arabia. So, and I've had this conversation actually with a Muslim man, and we were talking about, it was in D.C., and I said, well, you read the Quran, and I've heard you say and indicate some radical tendencies, but you say you're not. And he finally came to it, and I talked about Mecca and Medina and the abrogation and how when Muhammad went to Medina, then the violence came. And he just looked at me and he said, well, I'm in Mecca, meaning I'm in D.C. I'm surrounded by infidels. Of course I'm going to talk about tolerance.
Right. But don't expect me to practice it if the circumstances change. Raymond, we have to pause for one last break. We'll be right back with the final segment with Raymond Ibrahim of the David Horowitz Freedom Center, where he is their Shulman Fellow, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for the final installment of this really illuminating conversation with Raymond Ibrahim. He is with the David Horowitz Freedom Center, the Middle East Forum, and the Gatestone Institute. He has contributed enormously to the public policy debate and, I think, to the clearest thinking, the part of many of us, with respect to the challenge of our time in the form of Sharia supremacism and the Islam that it is seeking to impose on the entire world. Raymond Ibrahim, we've been talking about a number of different pieces of the challenge that we're facing in our own time from these jihadists. And I just wanted to drill down on a particularly fascinating line of attack, if I can use that expression, that I witness personally now, close hand, on the part of the Muslim Brotherhood and like-minded Sharia supremacists in this country. And that is to use something they've called interfaith dialogue and bridge building to advance their stealthy or civilization jihad. What can you tell us about both this technique and its traditions in the Islamic history?
Well, it actually, interestingly, it didn't have much precedent, and why that is, we'll get to, and it's actually eye-opening, and it has more to do with the West and Islam itself. But the idea of interfaith dialogue and, with the Abrahamic faiths and this idea of always trying to infuse Islam with Christianity and Judaism is a Western idea. So no Muslim actually came up with this, even though Muslims are willing to go along with it for the reasons that we'll get to.
So you're saying when people talk about the Abrahamic faiths, that this is actually not historically supported?
Anyone, any religion that talks about Abraham or Ibrahim, my namesake, in Islam, is somehow we're all related, Jews, Christians, and Muslims. That sort of thinking, of course, is very superficial, because there's while there are connections, there's way much greater contradictions, of course, within this. And if anything, I have found that the fact that Islam appropriates Abraham and Jesus and Moses and so forth, rather than actually make it closer to Christians and Jews, it actually is the source of contention and violence. For instance, if you looked at Buddhism and Hinduism, which have very little, nothing in common with, Judeo-Christianity and so forth, you don't see much of a divide or a war, civilizational war between these religions. But the fact that Islam took all these characters and then essentially changed them, because the superficial line you'll get from people who talk about this intolerant interfaith dialogue is that we all share the same characters, we all have the same core beliefs, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not true, because all these, so for example, let's look at Christ or Jesus in Islam. A lot of Christians who believe in interfaith dialogue will tell you, look, Islam, they revere Jesus and, et cetera, and they believe in so many of the things that the Bible teaches about him, including a virgin birth, et cetera, et cetera. But then you find that the Islamic Jesus, Isa, is also going to come on Judgment Day, kill all the pigs, break all the crosses, because he hates the fact that Christians believe that he died and was resurrected, and that they call him the Son of God and the Trinity. And so you can see why that actually creates more of a conflict than a connection. But it's always brushed aside. That's just one of the, this is a very deep topic, of course, but that's just one aspect that came to mind right now.
So when you are told, for example, as we have been of late, I'm sorry to say, by the Trump administration, that Abrahamic Faith Initiative, which has been launched by Pope Francis and Grand Imam, I believe, of the UAE, among others now, recently affirmed by Callista Gingrich, our ambassador to the Vatican, and others. We're witnessing basically a fraud. Am I overstating it? That this idea that we're all sort of one big happy faith community that shares the divinity, and more or less the worshiping of that divinity, it ain't necessarily so?
No, I agree. It's very fair for you to refer to it as fraudulent. Here's the big final picture idea. The people who promote this idea and who believe in it and who think it's the key to anything are mostly all living in the West and are either Jews or Christians or basically non-Muslims. In the non-Muslim world, participating in this sort of thing is again seen as strategic and smart. If for anything, to get the heat off of them, for example, to get criticism off them, to appear less of a threat, to have Islam and Sharia appear less of a threat.
And to, of course, insulate themselves against the charge that they're anti-Muslim, too. This is a big feature of this, I think.
Yes, but if you listen to them within their own conversations, it's very logical. And they say, sure, we have a couple of things in common.
When you say they, you're talking about these Sharia supremacist types, who are, we should be clear, are those who are leading up the Muslim cohort and participating in these kinds of conversations, in my experience.
Right. But it's just essentially, it's really a theological issue at this point, because whether you're a radical or not a radical, if you're a Muslim cleric, you're going to come down to it. Just like honestly, if you're a Christian or a Jew, you're going to come down to a point and say, yes, we have these things in common, but the things that we have not in common and which are a point of contention are much greater. And it really comes down to that.
Like, is Jesus Christ God or is he not God? I mean, it's kind of a binary choice and rather stark, it seems to me.
And if you're a non-Muslim, what do you make of Muhammad? Are you willing to accept that he was a prophet? Because if you do accept he's a prophet, then you need to start believing in the Quran because he prophesied it. He revealed it. So it really gets sticky. But again, for secular religious folks, I know that's an oxymoron, but you know who I mean. All this is fine and it's okay because it's all meant to be a superficial veneer anyway to make everything, you know, it's like a little Band-Aid, make everything look better. But deep down inside, things are still simmering and the hostility is still there.
And more to the point, the determination of the Sharia supremacists to impose their will on Jews and Christians and everybody else, for that matter, is absolutely unslackened. Let me ask you quickly, in the closing 2 minutes we have, Raymond, talk us through an important piece that you had recently on your website and in other places about the Palestinians. This is, of course, particularly interesting in the context of the new deal of the century the president has offered. What are we to make of the attitude of Muslims towards the Palestinians and, well, for that matter, towards Israel?
Well, what I found interesting is on May 29th of last year, in Jerusalem, in front of Al-Aqsa, a very large rally of Palestinians mostly gathered to celebrate the conquest of Constantinople, or today Istanbul, in Turkey, which happened in 1453 on May 29th. And throughout the whole rally, what they're saying and chanting to Allah Akbar is how wonderful it is for Muslims to invade and conquer non-Muslim territories, including, and they keep prophesying that Rome will be conquered by Islam. And they go on to say that until Islam spreads through jihad as far as it can, east and west, basically until the whole world is conquered. So that kind of talk, as you can see, it's squared very much with ISIS, Islamic supremacists, the Sharia supremacist ideology. But at the same time, these are the same people who, in the same breath, when they're talking, because all that I described was spoken in Arabic, and only Arabs really knew about this. But at the same time, these are the same people who, when they talk to the West or the non-Muslim world, will talk about how Palestinians are oppressed. Their land has been stolen. They're victims. They need justice. While in the same breath, they're extolling how wonderful it is to steal someone's land just because he's not a Muslim. And so it just becomes very clear that the whole Palestinian cause for most Muslims, especially of the supremacist variety, it's not about love for oppressed Palestinians. It's about hate for infidel Jews. And again, that just falls straight into line with what we're talking about. Again, the whole, you know, hostility for the other, et cetera, et cetera. It's just amazing to see, you know, in the same breath, the people saying, look at Palestinians, they're victims. At the same time, they're praising the idea of victimizing others.
Raymond, we're hard out of time, but hardly out of topics. I value so much your contributions to our program. I hope you'll come back to us very soon with more. This has been eye-opening and thought-provoking, and I hope that our audience will use this as a starting point for a much more deep read on your collective works, which are available at RaymondIbrahim.com. Check it out, folks, and do follow my friend Raymond Ibrahim. Thank you so much for joining us. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.